Okay. All right. So our topic for tonight is when Grant expelled the Jews. The story of General's Order Number 11 that took place on December 17th, 1862. And important book on the subject, as I mentioned, was that of Jonathan Sarno, professor from Brandeis, who's one of the leading or the leading American Jewish historian. The title is When General Grant Expelled the Jews. So there's a preface to the book which tells a funny story. And for those of you who read the book, maybe you remember this story. That is that when Jonathan Sarno was a young professor in 1982, he began his career before he was at Brandeis. He was at Cincinnati at Hebrew Union College, the Reform Rabbinical Seminary. And he was the professor of American Jewish history, replacing or coming on the heels of the long career of Jacob Rader Marcus, who was the dean of American Jewish historians, and at that time was about 90 some odd years old. And it was a tradition at HUC that if you wanted to be a tenured professor, you had to give a big lecture in front of the board of governors of the school. And it was Sarno's turn as a 26-year-old professor to do this. And so he chose as his topic General's Order Number 11, when Grant expelled the Jews from the Department of the Tennessee during the Civil War. Why? Because it was the 120th anniversary of the issuing of that decree. So it was a nice inyana dioma, so to speak. And he's telling the story, but he's not overly critical of Grant. And he acknowledges that there were Jewish smugglers who were engaged in illicit trade of cotton and other goods in the Department of the Tennessee that led to Grant issuing his order, including the Mack family, a Jewish family from Cincinnati who were clothiers and who were engaged in illicit trading of cotton together with Ulysses S. Grant's father, Jesse Grant. And so here you have a young professor defending a former American president and general who had this story about him, which was, you know, hostile to the Jews, and besmirching the Jews themselves. So after the lecture was over, a guy gets up from the audience and says, "My name is Mack." And Jacob Rader Marcus looks down like Fauci looked down when Trump says something about COVID, like Oy Vez Mir. And here, the great-grandson of the so-called smuggler was one of the members of the Board of Governors of HUC listening to Jonathan Sarno besmirch and Lashon Hara Rechilus about his great-grandfather. So the guy says, "My name is Mack, and it's all true." So at that point, Marcus and Sarno breathed a sigh of relief, no hard feelings. They were modala emes that the story was true. The Jews really were smuggling. Okay. So now let's tell the story of General Order Number 11. So Caesar Kaskel was born in Prussia and came to America in the 1850s. He came to Paducah, Kentucky in 1858. Now, Kentucky in 1861 did not join the Confederacy. It was a border state. And the sentiment in Kentucky was that in favor of the South. When the Union Army took over, there were many who said, well, they'd rather the other army be here. So this is Southern sentiment in town. There were very few pro-Union Jews. There were only 30 Jews in town, and only a few of them were pro-Union. But Kaskel and his brother Julius were. They were pro-Union. There was a disruption in trade between the border states and the South. In the Union Army, there were two schools of thought. One school of thought said, let's interdict all trade of cotton going northbound so as to starve the South of any financial resources. In other words, make them eat their own cotton. They can't literally eat it. It's not a food. It's a good for export, but if they can't export it, they'll die of starvation and we'll win the war faster. Others said, no, we don't want to do that. We want there to be the free flow of goods from those areas near the border and those areas which we have conquered so that the people who live there will be more inclined to support the Union, meaning they'll throw in the towel on the Confederacy and say, fine, we'll accept Union rule because Union rule is not so terrible. Grant had a sort of a wishy-washy in-between perspective. But in any event, the South wanted to export its cotton and they wanted to import finished goods, food, especially beef and bacon, and medicine. Illegal smuggling happened all along the border, together with legally sanctioned trading. There were those who had permits to go across the border and engage in commerce. Of course, those permits were issued by the military, and they were very sought after. How did you get such a permit? You had to know somebody, you know, protexia, or you had to bribe somebody. So who got the permit was a big deal. Jews stood to accused of engaging in illegal activities. Why? Well, first of all, the loyalty of Jews was always suspect, always suspect. Plus, there were Jews on both sides of this conflict, so you could legitimately claim that their co-religionists are playing for the other team. And also, there were Jews engaged in smuggling. On December 28th, 1862, Caesar Caskell was given an order by the local sheriff forcing him to leave Paducah within the next 24 hours. And in fact, it wasn't just him. Anyone born of Jewish parents was ordered to get out of the Department of the Tennessee. The Department of the Tennessee was not just the state of Tennessee. It was actually the area bounded between the Tennessee River and the Mississippi River in western Kentucky, southern Illinois, western Tennessee, and the whole state of Mississippi. This order of get out of the Department of the Tennessee applied to those parts of the department that were then controlled by the Union, which meant western Kentucky, western Tennessee, and the extreme western wing of Mississippi down to Vicksburg. Okay, so why should they be expelled from the department? Why must they leave their homes where they were residents in good standing? So the answer is because General Grant issued order number 11, and I will read the order to you. Let me read the order to you. Quote, "The Jews as a class, violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders, are hereby expelled from the department within 24 hours from the receipt of this order. Post commanders will see that all this class of people be furnished passes and required to leave, and anyone returning after such notification will be arrested and held in confinement until an opportunity occurs of sending them out as prisoners, unless furnished with permits from headquarters. No passes will be given to these people to visit headquarters for the purpose of making personal application for trade permits. So get out and don't think you're going to get a trade permit." Signed, General Grant from Holly Springs, December 17th, 1862. So Caesar Caskell wanted to appeal this order to a higher power, but there was nobody to be found. Shortly after the order was given, Confederate forces under Earl Van Dorn and the evil Nathan Bedford Forrest routed Union forces in the area and destroyed miles of telegraph lines and railroad lines. So because there was a breakdown in communications, as it turned out, Grant's order was not widely circulated, which meant that of the approximately 2,000 or 3,000 Jews who lived in this broad area, only about 100 were actually expelled from their homes. Caskell telegrammed the White House for immediate relief. Gotta help me, gotta help me. Lincoln probably never saw these telegrams. And the reason is because he was busy at that time drafting what important document, who knows? Who wants to unmute themselves and tell me what document was released on January 1st, 1863?
Gettysburg Proclamation.
The Emancipation Proclamation, good, good. So he's busy with something big relating to 4 million, well, not 4 million at the time because it only affected those not in the Confederacy, but related to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of black slaves, emancipate them. He's not as concerned with some order that was emanating from the Tennessee, from Grant. Okay, so he probably never saw it, but Caskell forwarded the story to the Associated Press. And the Associated Press published it widely in many newspapers around the country. Then Caskell set out for Washington to try to do his shtadlanut, his beseeching of the highest power to rescind an evil order. He stopped in Cincinnati along the way. And of course, once many prominent Jews found out about what was going on and that there were delegations going to Washington, every prominent Jew who thought he was a macher wants to do what? Go to Washington. Why? Because in case the order is going to be rescinded, everybody wants to have the glory of taking credit. It was me who caused the order to be rescinded. Everyone wants the kavod. Okay, and of course, if there's kavod to be had, just like if there's a camera, so you'll see Charles Schumer. So if there was kavod to be had, who was going to run after it in 19th century Jewish America? Isaac Meir Kahn. Okay, he was going to have to run for the kavod. Did the order of there were major questions that came up when it came to this order. Did it apply to Jewish soldiers? Did it apply to Jewish sutlers? What are sutlers? Sutlers are the guys who own like the portable general store near the army camps. They sell booze. They sell playing cards. They sell cigarettes. They sell provisions. Okay, did it apply to those people who were needed for the army to function? Some generals refused to implement the order. General Sullivan, the founder of Sullivan and Cromwell, a law firm, he said, "I'm an officer in the army, not an officer in the church." So he refused to implement it. Others waited for further clarification. So not that many Jews were expelled from their homes because there was a breakdown in communication, and some people thought this was ridiculous, and they couldn't imagine that it was going to really be a kosher edict. So Caesar Kaskel goes to Washington. He travels on Shabbos, because Pikuach Nefesh Docha Shabbos, and he arrives late on Saturday, January 3rd, 1863. Sunday, January 4th, he's ushered into the White House, and he has an encounter with Abraham Lincoln. And in this encounter, there's the apocryphal version, and the apocryphal version has Abraham Lincoln saying the following: "And so the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan?" And Kaskel replied, "Yes, and that is why they have come into Father Abraham's bosom, asking for protection." And Lincoln says, "And this protection they shall have at once." In other words, highfalutin biblical language about the land of America is the new land of Canaan, the land of Israel, the promised land, and the Jews are the stock of Abraham, and they're coming to Father Abraham for protection, and he's going to give the protection. Okay. Lincoln immediately revoked the order on January 4th. Quote, "To condemn a class is, to say the least, to wrong the good with the bad." Okay, that's right out of the Bible. Ha'af tisped tzadikim rasha, right out of the story of Abraham negotiating with God over the fate of the people of Sodom. Okay, Lincoln said, "I do not like to hear a class or nationality condemned on account of a few sinners." Now, the fact that he says condemned on account of a few sinners, what does that tell you about the underlying reason for the order?
Everybody.
Well, it tells me that there was an assumption made by Lincoln that the order was not, in its essence, designed to punish a religious group or an ethnic group for the sake of being cruel and torturing them because you don't like that group, but rather there really were a few sinners, except that the punishment being too collective was taking it too far.
Right. Wasn't there an omission of the word peddlers?
Yes, that's true. But and this is an important point. Jews were successful at smuggling and also legal trading precisely because they had a long history as peddlers and going into essentially what is hostile terrain or unfamiliar terrain. And that's why of all the different groups of people who might have engaged in the Civil War cross-border commercial activity, they were the best suited for it. Okay. Now, in Congress, the Democrats condemned Grant and the Republicans defended it. Here, the Republican president overruled Grant, but the Republicans are defending their general, and the Democrats who opposed the war are condemning him for being a bigot. A motion was put forth to condemn Grant, but it was tabled by the Senate by a vote of 30-7. Even those who disagreed with Grant's actions did not want to undermine public trust in one of the Union's leading soldiers. Now, this I could understand, meaning Grant is one of the leaders of the Union Army. He's going to be the head boss of the Union Army very soon. You don't want to have a public censure of the guy, even if he deserves it, because it's going to hurt the war effort. Okay. So the New York Times, at that point not yet owned by Jews, defended the Jews against Order 11 by saying, "All Jews are not swindlers, and all swindlers are not Jews." That's the New York Times defending the Jewish people. Good. Now, was America really different from all the other lands of the dispersion? That's what Jewish intellectuals had to grapple with in late 1862, early 1863, as the war is going on, and Jews are fighting on both sides. But here, the Union, at least briefly, is persecuting the Jews as a group. And we have to ask ourselves, is this a continuation of the experience of Galut, where it's always bad and it never ends well? Isaac Leiser sounded the alarm. Isaac Leiser, the traditional Jewish leader, a religious leader from Philadelphia, he says maybe America is replacing the lowest rung on the social ladder, that instead of it being blacks, now it'll be Jews. That it used to be there were black slaves, but now you have Emancipation Proclamation, so they're no longer at the bottom rung. Who's replacing them at the bottom rung? The dirty Jews. Okay? That's what he's afraid of. And he wrote a long 10,000-word essay that the Philadelphia Inquirer refused to publish, but he published in The Occident, bellyaching about what's going on. Several congressmen said nasty things about Jews around the same time, basically saying the Order 11 was a good order. You know, stick it to the Jews. They deserve it. And they called Judah Benjamin an Israelite with Egyptian principles. Now, if there ever was a derisive term, it was a pretty good one. How do you like that? An Israelite with Egyptian principles. Okay. Kudos to the congressman who mocked Judah Benjamin. They're an anti-Semitic son of a gun, but all right, they did a good job making fun of him. Okay. Now, the notion of Jews as a class reminded Jews of their pre-modern status, when they were not individual citizens of the state, but rather were a separate corporate body where the individual Jew had no relation to the state. So this seems like backsliding. The expulsion reminded Jews of prior expulsions, like the expulsion of Jews from England in 1290, from France in 1306, from Spain in 1492, Portugal 1497, Prague 1744. There were many expulsions of Jews, and we know all about it. And here, America, it's happening again. Some Jews really were involved in illegal activities and wrote about their adventures after the war. Meaning after the war, when there was no longer any fear of prosecution, some people opened up about what they did. They wrote of their adventures. And some people successfully made an illegal boondoggle, and some people got caught and lost all their money. Yesh for yesh. There was some in the column A and some in column B. Okay, so now we have to ask an important question. Why did Grant issue the order? He was legitimately concerned about smuggling. It was a real problem, not a fake one. But Grant himself had rescinded an earlier order of expulsion, which was of much more narrow scope, just a few weeks prior to December 17th. So what prompted him? What was the straw that broke the camel's back, the proximate cause of him expelling Jews from the Department of the Tennessee? So various theories were put out over the years, some with greater merit than others. The first theory is that he did it on orders from Washington, he was not in favor of it, but some high-ranking official in Washington told him to do it, possibly the Department of the Treasury. The problem with this is there's absolutely no evidence for it. It seems like total bunk. There's no evidence for it. A second theory is that military personnel wanted to monopolize the cotton trade and make a boatload of money off of it, and so they had to muscle out the Jews from the business. And so Grant was convinced by his underlings in the military to expel them from the territory. So the problem with this theory is, while it may very well be true that corrupt officers were looking to monopolize the trade and muscle the Jews out, Grant himself would not have gone for it, because Grant himself was of the opinion that the government, not private speculators, should engage in the sale of cotton and at fixed prices per bushel, per bale. And that no private citizen should make any profit whatsoever. The government should just increase its revenue. A third theory, and this theory seems to be the correct one, is that the Mack family from Cincinnati concocted a scheme with Grant's father, Jesse, to go down from Cincinnati to the Department of the Tennessee and ask General Grant, with the father being the go-between, for permits to engage in Southern cotton trade, with Grant's father getting 25% of the proceeds in exchange for his services of facilitating a meeting with the general. So this scheme was cooked up. It really did happen. But what happened? Ulysses Grant and his father, Jesse, were not on good terms. And the Mack family didn't realize that. That Ulysses Grant was, he had his foibles. He was a drunkard and all that. But he was basically an honest guy. And his father wasn't. His father was like a two-bit criminal. So Ulysses rejected the offer, and angry at the Jews for having swindled his father or gotten his father roped into it, he expelled the Jews from the territory. My apologies for not looking at the chat. Let me just look at the chat. Was the president so approachable? The answer is yes. Sounds like current events. Yes. What did Grant say after the repeal? Nothing. We're going to get to that. He was silent. Did the Confederacy take advantage from propaganda standpoint from the Grant order? The answer is no. However, the Southern states, after the war was over in 1868 in the election when Grant was a candidate, very much did so. And we'll talk about that in about 10 minutes from now. Then last one, Grant's personal animosity against the Jews is reputed to have been tied to having discovered Jewish families' use of his father's name to get legal cotton trade permits in Cincinnati. All right, that's Asher. The answer is yes. So it's a true story, and he was upset that the Jews had hoodwinked his father. Okay, so what happens next? The order is rescinded, and Grant says nothing about it. Julia, his wife, acknowledged that it was an obnoxious order, and that her husband deserved to be reprimanded. However, her memoirs were not published until 1975, 100 years later. In the moment, Grant did not express remorse. He was quiet. Some Jews thought he was Haman. Okay, he's Haman from the Purim story. So Grant kept quiet. He didn't want to say much. But what happens next? Well, the war goes on, and, you know, the Union wins, and Grant is a big hero. And in 1868, there's an election, and the incumbent is not running. All right, Andrew Johnson is out. He was an impeached president. He's not going to win. So it's now going to be an election of Horatio Seymour versus a Republican candidate. That Republican candidate is going to be Ulysses S. Grant. He was nominated by the Republican Party. Grant's slogan was, "Let us have peace." The Democrats tried to smear him by bringing back General Order Number 11. Oh, he's a bigot. He's an anti-Semite. Although the term anti-Semite wasn't used. Why wasn't it used? Because, and hopefully you'll read about it on Friday when I send out my weekly essay, I'm writing about the origins of anti-Semitism because of Parshas Noach and shame, the birth of shame. So anti-Semitism, the term, doesn't exist until 1879. We're talking 1868. So they try to smear him as a Jew hater. When confronted about it, Grant stayed quiet. But his surrogates acknowledged that Grant was sorry about what he did and that his intention was only to stop smuggling. It wasn't about Jews as a racial or religious group. It was simply a matter of preventing lawbreaking. Simon Wolfe was B'nai B'rith lawyer in Washington and was a Republican, and he was inclined to support Grant. The Seligman family, the rich bankers from New York, they had known Grant ever since he came into their shop in 1848 to buy clothing for his wife. And so they were buddies with him, and they also supported him. Republicans feared losing the Jewish vote. They dramatically overestimated the influence of the Jewish vote. On the other side of the aisle was August Belmont. August Belmont was a Jew by birth, but who had no connection whatsoever to the Jewish community. He wasn't a Meshumad, but he married Commodore Perry's daughter and had nothing to do with Yiddishkeit. He was a prominent Democrat. He accused Grant of attacking the Jews simply because they were Jews. So Democrats made up some fake news, fake news stories, but old news stories about Grant, claiming to explain why he persecuted the Jews. According to one story, it emphasized Grant's stupidity, that he was in with the Jews in illegal smuggling, but he was supposed to get one quarter of the profits, one fourth of the profits. When it was time to distribute the profits, what happened? He didn't get very much. The Jews gave him one eighth, and he was shocked to learn that one eighth is not as much as one fourth. Okay, so, you know, sometimes people don't know math. They don't know what's greater, one eighth or one fourth. If you're stupid, you think one eighth is greater than one fourth. So this was a story mocking Grant's intelligence. All right, it had no merit whatsoever. But this is the Democrats essentially trying to undermine Republican candidacy on the grounds of the guy's stupidity or he's evil and he hates the Jews. Okay, so the Jews had a basic question to deal with here. Should Jews vote for a party they consider to be bad for the country just to avoid voting for a man who had been bad to the Jews? Meaning, let's assume for the moment that the Democratic Party is bad for America in 1868. Why? Because they support Jim Crow, which will eventually emerge after Reconstruction is put to a halt. They rejected the Civil War. They rejected the Emancipation Proclamation. The Democrats equal inequality and bigotry, whereas the Republicans represent equality for all, the party of Lincoln. So should you vote for the bad party, the Democrats, just because the standard bearer of the Republican Party, the good party, happened to have once been done something bad to the Jews? That's the basic question. So Jewish Republicans argued that voting against the Republican candidate meant impeding the progress of history. Democrats were against civil rights and opposed the war. By contrast, Jewish Democrats called Grant a second pharaoh. He's like Paro Hasheni. And they considered any Jew who voted for him to be a renegade against his faith. Sound familiar? Sounds like an article from the Forward from last week, all right? Now, they also said, remember what Amalek did to you, that Grant is Amalek. The Jews will defeat Grant like they defeated Haman. Now, what distinguished the 1868 election was that for the first time ever, Jews justified their partisan loyalties on the basis of their religious identity. They campaigned as Jews. So Jewish partisan loyalties had been around since the early days of the Republic. There were Jewish Whigs, there were Jewish Democrat Republicans, there were Jewish Republicans, there were Jewish, every Federalists of every variety. You had Jews in every party. But their choice of party was on the basis of what they thought was best for America. In 1868, now you're talking about do what's best for the Jews, which might actually be different from what you honestly believe is best for America. Okay. So Jews had been getting involved in public affairs in the preceding decades. They were involved in the Damascus blood libel in 1840, the Muartara case in 1858, chaplaincy issues during the war. They were involved in rescinding General Order No. 11. But all these paled in comparison to the election of 1868. Jews were concerned, however, that if too much of a tumult was made about the Jewish vote, then it might stir up the old canard about a state within a state. So, yes, Jews care about politics, and there may be a particularistic reason why they care about a certain candidate or a certain party in any given election cycle, but it might not be a good idea to let the goyim know that. And so four rules were developed by the B'nai B'rith that arguably still hold true today, and I'll read them to you. Rule number one, Jews may not band together in separate political clubs. Well, now we do have the Jewish Republican Caucus and the Jewish Democratic Caucus. You have these things, but in the old days, don't band together for separate Jewish political clubs. Number two, rabbis or lay leaders have no right to advise the community on how to vote. Number three, Jewish agencies must not use their influence to promote Jewish aspirants to public office. Four, Jews may not support a candidate just because he happens to be Jewish. It reminds me of Kaminsky on the Five Towns. He had a robocall a couple of years back that you should vote for him because he's Jewish. I think Mel Brooks, who's his uncle, was the voiceover on that commercial. Okay. So these were some rules that, you know, they're not official rules, but Jews tended to prefer to follow them to avoid getting into trouble. Simon Wolf, the Republican, said, Jews are not Jews except to God. We are to the country what Mr. Smith and Mr. Brown are, citizens. Is this the same thing as be a Jew in your home and a person in the street? It's not exactly the same. It's more narrow than that. At least in the political realm, be a person as opposed to a Jew. You could be a Jew in the public space. You could wear your yarmulke. You could wear your talis on Shabbos when you walk to shul. And Simon Wolf is not restricting Judaism in any way, even in the public sphere. But when it comes to the political realm, your preferences and your mode of thinking ought to be governed by the macro issues of the nation, not the parochial issues of the Jews. Okay. Rabbi Liebman Adler of KM in Chicago, the big Reform shul, said that he would vote for Haman if that party would advance human rights. And he wouldn't vote for Moses if Moses was the head of the party that was opposed to human rights. In other words, the leader of the party, the devil or the saint, doesn't matter. What matters is what is this party going to do for universal values. So vote Republican because they say all men are created equal. Isaac Mira Wise disagreed. He said if wrong is wrong, then he who defends it is wicked. reminds me today of people who say, oh, you vote for this party, you're a bad Jew. And Wise said that you can't separate the Jew as a citizen from the Jew as a Jew. It's impossible. The two identities are so intertwined that trying to bifurcate them in an artificial way doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Is Isaac Mayer Wise right or wrong? What do you think? Is he right or wrong?
Depends how assimilated the Jew is.
You're right. So that's a good point. If a Jew is extremely assimilated, then it may very well be possible to separate the two out and have your political identity win out over your parochial ethnic identity. But assuming you're not so thoroughly, so far gone assimilated, it becomes extremely difficult to do. Okay.
So it's not fair to say black or white in a question like that.
Correct.
Because there are political issues that do affect Jews as right. Jews.
That's so true.
I can't see it.
I think in the 21st century, we would all acknowledge what you just said is correct, that there are issues that affect us as Jews. But in the 1860s, there was still a reluctance to even acknowledge that basic point. There was a working assumption that there are no issues that are specific to the Jews, or rather there shouldn't be. We're some sort of ethnic minority that shouldn't have parochial issues that are affected by American politics. So therefore, ignore all that stuff and just go with your gut at the national level. But I think today we would all acknowledge there are specifically Jewish issues. Okay, on September 14th, Grant sent a letter to Simon Wolf, not for publication, distancing himself from the November from the General Order Number 11 and disavowing all prejudice. Wolf thought that was good enough and said, fine, you have my seal of approval, my hechsher. Grant had done teshuva. But notice it wasn't for public consumption, meaning Grant really is sorry. But in 1868 America, could you openly acknowledge you're sorry to the Jews and not have it cost you politically in certain quarters? You couldn't. So therefore, he didn't. Okay. So in the end, the Jewish vote didn't matter at all. Grant won in a landslide in the Electoral College by a vote of 214-80. In Ohio and Pennsylvania, where Jewish voters were supposed to help the Democrats, Grant won by a wide margin. Only in New York, where Grant lost by 10,000 votes, might the Jewish vote have potentially made a difference to harm him, except that the vote in New York was probably rigged. The final tally was exactly 10,000 different. And whenever you have a round number in a national election, the suspicion is that somebody tinkered with the ballots. Okay. Now, after the election, in late November, Grant permitted the release of a personal letter in which he wrote, quote, I do not pretend to sustain the order. The order was sent and issued without any reflection and without thinking of the Jews as a sect or race. I have no prejudice against a sect or race, but want each individual to be judged by his own merit. Sounds like Martin Luther King Jr., except 100 years earlier. Order number 11 does not sustain this statement, I admit, but then I do not sustain the order, meaning he's acknowledging I have certain moral scruples, Grant is saying, and that order is inconsistent with it. But while I acknowledge that, I no longer approve of the order. I, in hindsight, say it was bad. It was bad. So, you know, don't hold me an account for it. I'm disavowing it. Okay. In the late 1860s and early 1870s, there was an attempt by some to downgrade the status of Jews in America. The National Reform Association, which was a fundamentalist Christian group, tried to pass a constitutional amendment making America expressly a Christian nation, a Christian state. Grant vigorously opposed this idea. He had a much more pluralistic view of America in that the black man is now a citizen, the Jew is a full citizen, and religious liberty is absolute. He appointed many Jews to government positions, and Judaism was gaining increasing respect in what was a brief golden age in his 8 years in office. Simon Wolf was appointed as recorder of deeds for the District of Columbia. He also became the administration's Jewish advisor. It was the first time any presidential administration had such an informal post, which continues ad yom hazeh till this very day, that there's like a Jewish liaison to the White House. That was Simon Wolf was the first one. By the way, as an aside, Simon Wolf gave a clerkship when he was recorder of deeds in Washington, D.C., to Frederick Douglass, who himself later became the recorder of deeds. And this is an example, a good example, of Jews treating blacks favorably and paving the way for blacks to enter into the mainstream of American society on the backs of Jews. Okay, Joseph Seligman, the rich banker, almost became Secretary of the Treasury, but he declined because his bank needed him back home. As a result of that, you would not have a Jewish member of the cabinet until Oscar Strauss in 1906 under Theodore Roosevelt. Grant tried to make Adolphus Solomons the governor of the District of Columbia, but Solomon refused for an interesting reason. He was Shomer Shabbos. Now, a lot of the Jews in the 1860s were not especially observant, but Adolphus Solomons was legitimately Shomer Shabbos. And so he refused the job because he reckoned that he would have to be involved in governmental administration involving Malacha on a regular basis on Saturdays. And so therefore he just felt he couldn't take the job. Edward Solomon, no relation to Adolphus Solomons, was appointed the governor of Washington Territory, not Washington DC, but Washington Territory in the Pacific Northwest. He was the first ever Jewish governor, not of a state, but of a territory. And this honor redounded to the benefit of all Jews. You know, he was the first ever Jewish governor. It was a big deal. The truth of the matter is he was a shanda and a charpa because Edward Solomon was crooked and he got caught stealing public money. In 1871, he gave a drasha on Yom Kippur on Kol Nidre night in the small little shul in Olympia, Washington, about teshuvah, about repentance and atonement. And the truth is he needed it because he got caught stealing with his hand in the cookie jar. Now, it's interesting what happened to him. He should have resigned immediately in disgrace, but he didn't want to. He wanted to save face because it wasn't public knowledge, actually, that he stole. It was like somewhat concealed the nature of his crimes. So he offered to resign effective in 3 months from now. And Grant was pressured to reject that offer of resignation in 3 months and say, no, you're fired immediately or resign immediately. But Grant did not do that. He allowed Edward Solomons to save face because Grant did not want to be seen as too tough on the Jews. Remember, Grant had to personally atone for General Order Number 11. And so for the rest of his career, throughout his years as president and beyond, he was always sensitive about not being too tough to the Jews. So even when a Jew was dirty and crooked and deserved it, Grant held back. So sometimes an ethnic minority has you over the barrel and you can't do what you need to do. So in foreign policy, President Ulysses S. Grant was very good to the Jews. Very, very good to the Jews. In what areas of foreign policy? Let's find out. So in 1869, the Russian government under Tsar Alexander II, he threatened to expel, issued an order to expel several thousand Jews living near the border in Bessarabia. The halacha was in Russia, the Tsarist rule was Jews couldn't live within like 7.5 miles of any border, lest they engage in smuggling and other illicit activities. But the border changed because of the Treaty of Paris in 1859, so on and so forth. So Jews all of a sudden were near the border, and the Tsar wanted to expel them. So the Jews in America turned to President Grant and say, you got to help us. You got to protest against Russian persecution of the Jews. So we get to a very, very interesting point, something maybe you never thought about before. In the 20th century, you have certain things that were said by presidents. Ich bin ein Berliner, I'm a jelly donut. Or Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. American presidents use their bully pulpit as the leader of the free world to boss around tyrants in the third world and in the Eastern Bloc to be better to their people. You know, don't be such evil scoundrels. Be good to your citizenry. Don't treat them badly. So American foreign policy is based in large measure on issues of human rights and human decency, you know, for the people the world over, not just for American citizens. But that was in the 20th century. It wasn't true in the pre-Civil War era. Why not? One word. What's the answer? One word. Slavery. How could America exert any moral authority in the world when they had slavery long after most other developed countries or westernized countries did not? So, for example, in the Mortara case in 1858, the Jews in America wanted the administration of James Buchanan to vigorously protest against the church and the papal states for stealing a baby, a six-year-old boy, from a Jewish family. But how could America do that when on a daily basis, black slave families in the American South were broken apart? So there was moral authority. So therefore, it was just not an issue in American foreign policy. But after slavery has been done away with, then maybe things can change. So Grant was inclined to be sympathetic to Jewish interests in Russia, and his sympathetic ear became publicly known. The Secretary of State, Hamilton Fish, did not like this. He preferred to maintain the old perspective of America doesn't try to impose its morality on other countries in their internal affairs. And so he tried to stay Grant's hand in issuing a proclamation. In the end, no statement was released by Grant. However, because the Russians knew what Grant felt because of it was public knowledge, it's possibly the reason why the Tsar's order was rescinded. It's also possible that the Tsar rescinded his order for economic reasons, but you never know. Maybe the international outcry, especially from America, played some kind of a role. Then, a year later, the situation develops with the Jews in Romania. Romania was always terrible to the Jews, terrible. And there were rumors floating around in the U.S. that the Romanians had a pogrom and killed 1,000 Jews. As it turned out, that wasn't true. But there was persecution of Jews in Romania. It was very, very bad. It's just not that 1,000 Jews were killed. So the Jews turn to Grant and say, "We want your help. And the help that you could offer is to send a Jewish person as the U.S. Consul General in Bucharest." So, good idea. So the Jews were going to, so Grant was going to send Adolf Buchner, who actually wasn't an American citizen, but was a Jew living in America of Romanian extraction. However, Rabbi Chaim Tzvi Schneerson, the grandnephew of Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Balat Tanya, and a relation to all the Lubavitcher Rebbes, he was an Israeli rabbi who came to America, was doing the speaking tour, and he actually came to America to protest the American consul in Jerusalem was someone who wasn't good to the Jews, and he wanted a more pro-Jewish consul general in Jerusalem from America. But while he was in America, he spoke to Grant and said, "Oh, I have the man for you to send to Bucharest, Benjamin Franklin Pesaro, a Sephardic Jew, okay, nonetheless a traditionally religious Jew. Send him to Bucharest, and he'll defend the Jews in Romania." So Seligman paid for the ticket, for the airfare, you know, for the boat fare, and they sent Pesaro, and his main portfolio items were to protect Jewish interests. There were those who didn't like that. They said he's an American civil servant, a State Department employee. He should protect broader American interests, not just Jewish concerns, but, you know, the main concerns were Jewish concerns. Okay. In Grant's letter to Pesaro, which was supposed to be presented to the Romanian government, Grant wrote the following. This is very important. "The United States, knowing no distinction of her own citizens on account of religion or nativity, naturally believe in civilization the world over, which will secure the same universal liberal views." So the Jew, America, we don't distinguish on the basis of religion. We don't reckon these things. A citizen is a citizen. Therefore, we hope that the world over, the same will hold true. That in all countries, you'll just have citizens without regard for religious identity. Okay. In 1872, Grant was running for re-election, and it was basically a cakewalk. It was not a hotly contested election. His opponent was Horace Greeley. It was a landslide. At this point, the Democrats tried to trot out General Order Number 11 to smear him again, but it didn't work. Even Isaac Mayer Wise, the Democrat, acknowledged that Grant had atoned for that sin and is a good guy, basically. and even Southern Jews supported Grant. Now, that's surprising. Here, Grant was a leader of the Union Army, and Southern Jews had fought for the Confederacy. But, you know, bygones are bygones. He's a good president. He's good to the Jews. Even they supported him. Grant's second term was very scandal-plagued, not because he was doing anything wrong, but because of his cabinet members who were basically corrupt. So from a Jewish perspective, Grant's second term is remembered largely for his efforts to separate church and state. An alliance developed between Jews, liberal Christians, free thinkers, and secularists, in which they opposed government funding of religious parochial schools. And in fact, Grant supported the passage of a constitutional amendment, which would make it a requirement for states to establish public school systems which were free and which did not teach any religious doctrine. So you could understand why, from a Jewish perspective, that would be a great thing. I mean, now we want day schools and yeshivas and all that, but, you know, in a bygone era, what did you want? Public school education that didn't have the Lord's Prayer and all the goyish zachen. You wanted to have religiously neutral public schools. Would be a great thing. Okay, that's what Grant supported. Who were the enemies of this coalition? So the enemies of this coalition were the evangelicals, who were fundamentalist Protestant, and to a certain extent, even the Catholics were on the other side of the issue, because they wanted government funding of parochial schools. Okay. In Grant's last year as president, 1876, he attended the dedication of Congregation Adas Yisrael in Washington. There was a three-hour service of dedication. Now, I, having been the assistant rabbi at Park East Synagogue for 5 years, I met many politicians and diplomats and heads of state and so on and so forth. And they came to, you know, to the shul for whatever various occasions. And they come with their security guards, you know, at 10:37. They give their two-minute spiel, and by 10:53, they're out of the building. And when the Pope came, he was in the building for a total of 19 minutes, you know, Erev Pesach 2008. 19 minutes, I had my clock running. But Ulysses S. Grant came to a shul dedication and stayed for 3 hours. Why? Because he could not leave early. You know, he couldn't offend the Jews. He owed the Jews a certain measure of contrition, and forever, for 20 years of his life after General Order Number 11, he always was doing the right thing by the Jews. He also made a $10 donation to the shul. Then, Grant went on a world tour after he was no longer president. He spent several years abroad traveling the world with his wife, Julia. He also went to Eretz Yisrael, to Palestine. He was disappointed with what he saw. What did he see? That it was a wasteland, that Eretz Yisrael was not Eretz Zavat Chalav Udavash, the land flowing with milk and honey. It was a land flowing with nothing, with mosquitoes. Okay, and like Mark Twain, he bemoaned the fact that it could be a great country, but right now it very much isn't. It's kind of, you know, just blight. So Grant thought that the solution to the Jewish problems in Romania and in Russia was not move to Israel, not Zionism, but rather move to America. And in the years of Grant's presidency in the 1870s, many Jews did move to America from Romania and from Russia, Poland. We tend to think of the great wave of immigration starting in 1881 after the pogroms, but the truth of the matter is there is already a significant uptick in immigration from East Central and Eastern Europe early in the 1870s, okay? And Grant did not oppose the arrival of Jews. He was very much in favor of it. While Grant was in Israel, a schnurrer came up to him asking for Hachnasas Kala, and he gave the guy $25. It's a lot of money. Also, there were about 100 American Jews living in Israel at the time. And, you know, in those years, how did people earn a livelihood in Eretz Yisrael? So they didn't really earn a livelihood. They took charity. And the charity was known as the Chalukah. So if you remember from our Zionism course, we discussed this at length a few years back. So the Chalukah was based upon geography. Where did you come from? What was the Alter Heim? You were in a kolel. There was Ungarish kolel, the Polish kolel, the Romanish kolel, the Litvish kolel. Every region in Europe had a kolel of people in Eretz Yisrael. But there was no Americanish kolel. So the American Jews in Israel were requesting from Grant that he approached the American Jews and try to solicit money from them. Nothing ever happened from it, but it's just a funny story about his time in Israel. After the 1881 pogroms, Grant, who was living in New York, was at the top of a petition. He signed the top name of a petition calling for a big rally in a massive hall in New York City to protest the Russian government's treatment of the Jews in the pogroms. So again, he's always looking out for the Jews, and his support is solicited and is never missing. Grant lost all of his money later in life to a Madoff-style partner, not in the sense that the guy was a Jew. No, he wasn't a Jew like Madoff. He was a goy. But Grant lost all of his money. So because he lost all of his money in the last year of his life, he wanted to write his memoirs that could be sold and support his family. But then he developed cancer and got very sick, and he died at not such an old age. He was in his early 60s. So when he was sick, the Jews prayed for him. And he acknowledged in a letter, one of the last letters that he wrote, how appreciative he was that he was getting prayers from Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. What's so important about saying Protestant, Catholic, Jew? Who knows? Who knows their American history, 20th century history? What's so important about that? Anybody know? Who coined the expression Protestant, Catholic, Jew? Which sociologist? Nobody knows? Okay, Will Herberg. Will Herberg in the 1950s wrote about how America has three major religions, Protestant, Catholic, and Jew. Very inclusive perspective to include the Catholics and the Jews. After all, America is a WASP country, at least it had been, only over time developing a melting pot theory. So for General Grant, ex-President Grant, in 1885, decades and decades before it was popular to speak of three major religions in America, to say I'm thankful to the prayers of Protestant, Catholic, and Jew goes to show you how inclusive his spirit really was. Okay. He died just before Shabbos Nachamu. So all the big Rabbanim in America and the not-so-big Rabbanim gave drushes, comforting the people over the loss of their beloved ex-president. Now, a man who had been regarded as Haman, but now was regarded like a Mordechai because he stepped up to defend Jewish interests. All sorts of legends developed about Grant. One was that he kept kosher. This is not true at all. However, it is true that he didn't like eating blood in his meat. He didn't like rare, even medium well meat. He wanted well done. So like Hilchas Malicha, he wanted to have a charred steak because he believed in biblical values of no blood. Okay. Now, when Grant died, the question was, in eulogizing him, how far do you go in singing his praises and in whitewashing the major blemish on his record, General Order Number 11? So most of the rabbis gave a sort of a balanced approach, but on the whole tilting towards positive, because after all, in the later years, it was positive. However, Rabbi Edward Benjamin Morris Brown, who was the preacher in one of the shuls in New York, now this shul would go on to become Park Avenue Synagogue several iterations later, he gave the propagandistic pro-Ulysses S. Grant version, in which he said that the General Order Number 11 was not Grant's doing. It was forced upon him by Washington, that in all of Grant's actions vis-a-vis the Jews, he was a tzaddik gomor, a righteous one.
He did himself.
Now, because of that, Grant's funeral, the organizers wanted to use this guy, this Rabbi Brown, to be the Jewish clergyman at the funeral. So they chose him, which meant overlooking and snubbing a lot of other more important rabbis. Now, I'm in the rabbi business, and I know what my colleagues like all the kavod. And if there's a big event, you know, who's going to get invited to the White House Hanukkah party? Who's going to get invited to this, that? Everybody wants to be the one who gets invited. Okay, so the more prominent ones were furious that this Chemyankel Brown was getting invited to give the drasha at the funeral. Okay, well, it's interesting what happened. Brown had a problem on his hands. The funeral was on a Shabbos, on a Saturday. It was the next Shabbos after Shabbos Nachmu, so it was Parshas Ekev. Well, the funeral is in Riverside Park. Grant decided he's going to be buried in Riverside Park, 122nd Street off of Broadway, off of, near the river. But the shul, where Brown lives, is downtown. It's a 7-mile distance. Everybody was going from downtown, from like the Wall Street area, in a procession with horse and buggy up to Riverside Park. It was a several hour long procession with the casket and the horse and buggy. And they wanted the Jewish reverend to participate. But he didn't want to. It was a Shabbos. Now, the truth of the matter is, he wasn't an Orthodox rabbi. He was a moderate Reform rabbi, which means that he wasn't really Shomer Shabbos. Now, he wasn't a radical. He was not an extremist Reform. The extremist Reform would have said that Sabbath is on Sunday, you know, Sunday Sabbath. But he was against that. And he wanted to defend Saturday Sabbath as a Jewish institution. So even though he wasn't personally Shomer Shabbos, he decided he's going to walk. They said, you can't. He says, I won't go. They said, fine, you can walk. Because they really wanted him there. They wanted a Jewish rabbi who was pro Ulysses S. Grant. So he walked all the way. And the reformers, they mocked him for it. They said, you think you're so frum? You're Machal Shabbos even while walking. Why? Number one, you carried an umbrella. Number two, it's beyond the Trum Shabbos of 2,000 Amos. So you were Machal Shabbos in two different ways, thinking you're so frum that you're going to walk. The Orthodox, who would have to tacitly acknowledge that, yeah, you shouldn't carry an umbrella and walk beyond the Trum, they gave him a gold medal for being a Kiddush Hashem that he walked and defended Saturday Sabbath. So a very odd thing where a moderate Reform rabbi is being heralded as a savior by the Orthodox and being mocked for being insufficiently frum by the Reform. Okay. Grant went from being a Haman to a Mordechai. And you could also argue that he was like Bilam, that Bilam began as a curse and ends as a blessing, that General Order Number 11 was bad for the Jews, but in the end, General Order Number 11 transformed the Jewish community in America into being more politically active and proactive for its own interests. So what could have been a disaster turned out, with the passage of some time, to be a great benefit. The Jews were no longer docile and willing to just take whatever comes their way. There was some pushback, and successful pushback at that. So Lincoln is recalled as Father Abraham, as a great hero for the Jews, and Grant, initially the villain, does teshuva and is recognized as a good guy. Now, in the long scheme of things, most Jews in America today never heard of Grant's General's Order Number 11. Never heard of it. Most Jews who know a little Jewish history, they do know about it. But even the ones who know a little history don't know what I told you tonight, that he did tshuva for his sin. So we're here tonight to rectify the flawed perception of American Jewish history. He did an Aveira. It was his Aveira. It wasn't foisted upon him, but there was sincere repentance. Okay, so we'll stop here. Next week, we're going to discuss the chaplaincy issue. Jews in the Civil War trying to have their own clergymen in the military. And we'll discuss issues of Jews fighting in the war for both sides from a uniquely Jewish perspective. And then after that, we'll go, I think, beyond the Civil War era. Okay, everybody have a good night.
8:15
every week.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you. One thing.